My name is Francina Turner, and I'm conducting an oral history interview with Halima Jenkins, a graduate of the University of Maryland College Park for the Reparative Histories and the Black Experience Oral History Project. I want to start with, was your name at the time that you were at UMD Halima Jenkins?
Yes.
Okay.
I never changed it when I got married.
Okay. What's your hometown?
Where I live now or where I grew up?
Where you grew up.
Silver Spring, Maryland.
Okay. And what's your birthday?
February 15th, 1978.
Okay. And for our first sort of discussion, I'm interested in how you would describe your life prior to UMD in terms of like your family composition, your family's feelings and thoughts on education, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So in terms of my family, you know, before I went to college, I grew up with my mom and dad, and I have a brother who's 2 years younger who also went to University of Maryland College Park. My mom is a career teacher. She's retired now, but I grew up in a house where education was highly valued. So both of my parents went to McAllister College in St. Paul, Minnesota. That's where they met and got married. And when I was really little, like pre-K, I mean, you know, before kindergarten, my mom stopped working when my brother and I were born and got her master's degree in business administration, and then worked for a year in business, finance, marketing, and then decided to change gears to teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And she liked that we would kind of be on the same schedule, you know, have summers off together, mm-hmm. Holidays off together. And she really, really is passionate about teaching. My dad got his master's degree when he started when I was in high school, and he finished while I was in college. My dad's parents were really highly educated, especially for a Black family. You know, back then, my parents were born in the early 1950s. And so, you know, his dad graduated from Howard University, mm-hmm. and his mom, my paternal grandmother, you know, she's from Calvert County, Maryland. You know, his mm-hmm. dad's from DC. And of course, under segregation, you know, she made it very clear to me many, many times that when she was graduating high school, University of Maryland at College Park was not an option because mm-hmm. it was still segregated, of course. So the option for Black students who wanted to go, of course, was University of Maryland Eastern Shore. Mm-hmm. So by the time I was accepted into University of Maryland, and especially with the Banneker Key, you know, full scholarship, I heard many times about how you know, different that was from her time, mm-hmm. you know, looking at 46 years later. And so she ended up, she got her, my dad's mother, she ended up getting her bachelor's degree while my dad was in high school. And then she got her master's degree right after that. And then she was a career teacher, okay. And retired teacher. But in general, I'll say my family really highly values education. And so that was a very clear and constant message from the time I was very young all the way through into the university.
How did you make the decision to attend UMD?
Well, I, to be honest, I only applied to two schools. I applied to UMD and University of Maryland, well, UMBC mm-hmm. was the other one. And I thought about applying to Goucher or some of the other private colleges in the state of Maryland. But for family reasons, I was only allowed to apply locally.
Mm-hmm.
And I also knew that I was going to have to figure out how to pay for college, because that's something that, you know, my parents articulated. So it was very clear to me that, you know, the private schools in Maryland were going to be very expensive. The in-state schools were going to be much more affordable. And, you know, of the ones that were in the University of Maryland system, UM College Park and UMBC were the only two really that I was interested in. So I focused on those two. And then of the two, College Park was the one that I preferred over UMBC. And they offered me a full scholarship. So that kind of made my decision really easy.
Okay. What year did you enroll at UMD?
1996.
And then did you come in knowing what you wanted to major in, or is that something you chose once you got there?
I did know what I wanted to major in. So I declared a major right away. And even in my application, I wrote about, you know, what I wanted to major in. So, there was no gap year or anything like that. So I graduated high school in 96 and I started college in 96 and I enrolled as a French major. And I knew that's something that I wanted to do because I was passionate about languages and I was a third generation French and English speaker. And my kids now are fourth generation, you know, French and English speakers. So I knew that was something that I wanted to use in whatever profession I ended up in. So I didn't approach college with the sense of, okay, I am choosing a major to do a specific thing, you know, as opposed to an engineer or a comp sci, business, finance, an education major. You know, they go to college and then they are lined up for a specific profession. My approach when I went into college was I thought about, well, what am I really passionate about? And whatever I'm passionate about is the thing that I'm going to enjoy studying. And I feel like, therefore, these are skills that can translate to a lot of different areas. So going into it, I said, well, you know, maybe I'll end up teaching French, or maybe I'll work in business bilingually, or maybe I will, you know, go abroad and do something. But I led with, what am I excited about in terms of shaping my college experience?
Okay.
Prior to that, going to French was a little bit of a departure for me because I had been in very intense STEM magnet programs for middle school and high school. So I went to the math, science, and computer science magnet program at Tacoma Park Intermediate School, now it's middle school, in Montgomery County. And then I attended Montgomery Blair High School in Silver Spring for the STEM magnet program. And at the time that I went, those programs, you know, now they're very nationally recognized, but at the time it was still in the earlier stages of the program and they were well recognized then too. But what I'll say is I was probably maybe around the seventh, you know, graduating cohort to go through those programs. But you didn't see a lot of females in science or the STEM fields in the 90s. It was an emerging thing and you started to see, oh, these females in science groups, or you started to see some encouragement there, like, oh, maybe this is a thought, you know, the women doctor, you know, still kind of a niche thing. And so I was excited. I love math, I'm passionate about it, and I still love science. But what I found by the end of, you know, all those 6 years of that intense STEM was that I was kind of burnt out, shall we say. And I still love science to this day, but socially, culturally, it was a tough hill to climb as a Black female, I'll just say that. And I think that it takes a lot of grit to stick with it. In the programs that I was in, they were predominantly white and Asian. And there was a lot of feeling of, or very blatant communication from other students. You got this because they just needed a Black female to fill the slot, and you know, that type of, oh, you're an affirmative action handout kind of communication. And it doesn't matter what your performance was, that just was a lot of the air and attitude toward the Black and brown students in programs like that. So by the time I was applying to college, even though I loved the health sciences, biology, I still read about those things for fun. Mm-hmm. I just mentally wanted to shift into a space where I just felt like I would feel comfortable in my skin. So I ended up with French, which I was also very excited about. And after I entered as a French major, after my first semester, I realized that I wanted to also do the dance certificate program. Mm-hmm. And there was a professor, I just randomly signed up for a dance class because I love to dance. I had taken many, many dance courses over the years. And so she really pushed me to major in that. Her name was Miriam Rosen. She went by Mim Rosen. She was in the dance department a long time, but she's since deceased. So she really tried to convince me to join the dance major. I said, I already have a major. She said, you can do both. I said, well, I also want to do study abroad. She said, well, I have a student doing that. I said, I want to go for a year. She said, ooh, okay, all right. And I want to graduate in 4 years. She's like, okay, we'll do the certificate program. I said, all right, fine. That was our compromise. And I was very happy with that. Mm-hmm. And then I also took a lot of Spanish classes. Mm-hmm. That's my third language. And so so that's kind of how I ended up in that path of what I chose to study and why. Really, like I said, I led with what was going to make me feel satisfied. And I had control over something that I wanted to do in my life kind of for the first time, my first mm-hmm. foray into adulthood, you know, 18. Because I had the scholarship, it gave me an opportunity to resist pressure from family members to tell me what I shouldn't do because they weren't paying for it. So that, you know, was very convenient. So with that, I was happy. And then I did end up taking advantage of the study abroad program at University of Nice, which is affiliated with the University of Maryland. So when you apply, you're taking courses at the University of Nice. Well, it has a new name now, but at the University of Nice. And there was a University of Maryland professor that they sent with the group. And you also were enrolled in a University of Maryland course concurrently, but over in France. So you end up with actual UMD course on your transcript plus your transfer credits from the university. So I came back home with 39 credits that 1 year that I went.
Which academic year? So freshman, sophomore, junior,
senior? Oh, my junior year. So I was there 98 to 99.
Okay. Can you walk me through your memories of the first time you walked onto campus as a freshman? What sticks out to you from that experience?
Sure. I think it's worth saying, though, that my freshman year was not my first time walking onto campus. So when I started as a freshman, I felt a sense of familiarity because I had been on the campus so many times before. I had used the McKeldin Library multiple times before. So there was a lot of excitement there. I remember feeling elated to be, you know, away from home and living in a dorm, actually being an enrolled student and using the libraries that I had already been using. And I loved the McKeldin Mall. That was one of my favorite things about the campus, the way that it's a big kind of grassy mall and lined with trees on the side. And my favorite, one of the things I look forward to and that I still have fond memories of is in the fall when the leaves turn colors and it's just like it's lined with red, orange, yellow, green, and brown. So I was excited for a new adventure. And I remember feeling very proud to be there. Very appreciative of the opportunity to go to college and be on scholarship, but also I could appreciate the contrast between my experience and my grandmother's, you know, at that time, being 18 and being able to go there. So I had a very, I think coming from, at least on my father's side, a family that's been in Maryland for so many generations, you know, I was very clear on the oral histories of segregation and afterward, and, you know, and what did that look like, and how were my opportunities different from just a generation, you know, before me or two. Oh, you're on mute.
Thank you. While you were a student, did you live on campus or off campus or commute?
I lived on campus the whole time. Mm-hmm. So my first 2 years, I lived out in the high rises. So I lived in Easton, which was right there. Out my window was University Boulevard. It was mm-hmm. on the farthest edge of campus, at least as far as those quads are concerned. So I lived there for my first 2 years. And then my third year, as I mentioned, I was in Nice, France, and I lived in an apartment there with with three other female students. Two were from the University of Maryland, and one was from Wisconsin, but just joined our program for the year. Mm-hmm. That was a very interesting, racially charged experience. I'll just put a footnote on it if you want to go back to that one. Mm-hmm. And then my last year when I came back, I lived also on campus housing in South Campus. Okay. So I was close. I was really close to the South Campus dining hall and the old dance building before they tore it down.
Okay. Did you belong to any campus-based social organizations and clubs did you belong to? And did you hold any leadership positions?
Sure. Mm-hmm. I had my toe dipped in a whole lot of different organizations. So I participated with the CSA, the Caribbean Student Association, and also the LSU, Latino Student Union. But when I started, it was the Hispanic Student Union, and then it changed name, you know, I think after my first year or by the end of my first year. I also used to participate with the Hispanic Heritage Coalition. I did a lot of volunteering with C Productions. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Oh, and when I came back from France, my senior year, I did a lot of work with the Black Explosion newspaper. So I was the head copy editor. I worked really closely with Rahman Culver, who was the editor-in-chief at the time. So together we doled out the assignments. We mm-hmm. did all of the layout and graphics work for each issue, communicated with the printer, which was the Daily Record out of Baltimore. you know, packaged up the files and oversaw the distribution of the printed issues when they came to campus. And it was published biweekly. Let's see what else. I did some participation with the Black Student Union, but not nearly to the extent of the other groups that I mentioned. And I was also very heavily involved in my last year with the Saturday Freedom Schools program, both my last year and also after I graduated. That next year, I came back to volunteer and take an active role in the running of that program. So for the Saturday Freedom Schools, that program was a complete brainchild of Rahman Culver. The year that I was in France, it was for both of us our junior year, he conceived of the program, fundraised for it, applied and received a grant to fund it for the fall of 1999. And it focused on really trying to be an instrumental force for Black middle school students. At the time, we were working with Greenbelt middle school students, but years later, it shifted to working with students at Buck Lodge Middle School in Prince George's County. The two middle schools aren't far from each other, so you're still looking at a similar dynamic, you know, of school and demographic population. But for on Saturdays, the kids would come on campus, and each student was paired with a college mentor that would, you know, literally sit with them the whole time and go through all the activities. And there was always a math lesson, which is where I came in. And I'll come back to that. There was an art lesson, an ongoing culminating activity, you know, that they would work on every week and culminate with a project at the end, as well as, and this took up probably at least 50% of the time, targeted Black studies enrichment lesson. Mm-hmm. And all of that at the end culminated with a trip to the Smithsonian. And we got a school bus, a yellow school bus and everything, and went to go see the Field to Factory exhibit, which no longer exists, but it was wonderful. It was wonderful. And it takes you on kind of like a depiction of Black history through the Great Migration. And so the students got to see, you know, this very rich, well-curated, thought-out display of the same types of lessons that we were trying to give them. Mm-hmm. So Rahman conceived of the whole program. He secured the funding, he secured the volunteers, he secured the space to be used on campus, the forums, et cetera. And he also was the lead instructor for that portion of the program. And I helped him a lot with a lot of the logistics, the behind the scenes stuff that happened in between the Saturdays. But also I ended up creating the math curriculum for that program, and I taught it for 2 years in a row. And that happened kind of on a fluke. I originally signed up to be a volunteer. I was just gonna be a mentor. Mm-hmm. And the Greenbelt Middle School at the time had said that it would provide the math, what they thought would be math enrichment that the students needed. And it was, I wanna say, a week or two before we were starting with the first students. And there was some kind of mix up because they weren't providing math anything. Mm. But we were having all these students come, and I had tutored math before. I was really familiar with the middle school you know, math 7, math 8, algebra, you know, content. So I just created what I thought they needed. And at the time, my mother was teaching middle school math. Mm-hmm. So I remember I called her. I said, listen, this is what I'm thinking. You know, what am I leaving out? So, you know, she consulted on that and we put it together. And that's what we did.
Okay. You've told me kind of how you came to be involved with the Freedom Schools, but how did you determine, like, which, how did you make decisions about which organizations you would devote your time to?
Ah, okay. So in my first 2 years, which is when I did a lot with, like I said, the Caribbean Student Association, well, I'll stick with that one. Mm-hmm. I have Caribbean heritage on my mother's side, from Barbados. And so I guess with the idea that, you know, we are intersectional people. You know, we don't just, most of us just fit into like one tribe, one group, one whatever. When I looked, similar to when I talked about what I wanted to study, I looked at going to college as an opportunity to, you know, explore things that felt meaningful, that sparked joy, that allowed me also to explore themes surrounding identity and I'm naturally very heavy into culture and language, which, you know, hence the language studies. But so I knew when I went in that, well, these were things that I wanted to, you know, kind of branch out and try. So I tried out the Caribbean Students Association and I felt very at home there. And I participated with a lot of events. I mentioned earlier that I wasn't as heavily involved with the BSU. I loved the idea of it. And I had a lot of friends in the BSU, but I also at the time found there to be a lot of politics involved, even some color politics, you know, that I didn't enjoy or want to be a part of. I ended up involved in the Hispanic Student Union turned Latino Student Union out of my friendships. I had, you know, as a freshman, and you know, you're kind of exploring these different clubs, you know, they have clubs, mm-hmm. and organization fairs, and I had a lot of students who were joining the Hispanic Student Union, and they said, oh, come with us. I said, oh, okay, sure. And I did, and I really enjoyed that student union, so I stayed participating in it. And related to that, I had, you know, several friends in the LSU mm-hmm. who also were part of the Hispanic Heritage Coalition. So then I would participate in that as well. So that's kind of what drove those. I'm trying to recall what else I was involved in my first 2 years, but I think that was primarily it. Oh, and C Productions, mm-hmm. and that was another one. I had friends who were doing that, so I would just volunteer, you know, it was some of those things. And I enjoyed the events. Mm-hmm. So I think that was the bulk of that. Otherwise, I was also involved in the dance community at University of Maryland. And I was encouraged to try different things by two professors in particular. One, Miriam Rosen, I mentioned. Mm-hmm. The other one is still in the dance department, Alvin Mays. He's a wonderful, wonderful choreographer. He used to have his own dance company when he was a little younger. And he and I are still in touch, but he was a wonderful mentor to me while I was in the program. But I auditioned for, you know, I was active in auditioning for things and even performing.
Mm-hmm.
I performed in the 97-98 school year with the Maryland Dance Ensemble. And I also performed that same year with a Puerto Rican folk dance troupe called Sangre Caribeña. And I knew the leader of that troupe, main choreographer from, you know, on camp. We were friends on campus. We'd taken mm-hmm. dance classes together, and she invited me to come in and help with the choreography for a showcase that they were part of that was taking place at on campus, the Hoff Theater. And, oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was gonna say, and then when it was getting close to time to perform, they're like, dance with us. I said, okay, sure. but that was primarily my involvement before going to France. While I was in France, I was pretty disconnected from the College Park campus. And at the time, you know, in 98-99, we had internet here and email and computers, but over there, you know, not so much. So there was, I was pretty disconnected. And then when I came back, my primary involvement was, like I said, with the Black Explosion and the Saturday Freedom Schools. And I still was very active with the dance department,
mm-hmm.
and showcased a piece for new dances in the spring semester. And then a little bit active with the Latino Student Union and the Caribbean Student Association.
Okay. What did you belong to any off-campus civic or social organizations, a church or anything like that?
Not in the 4 years that I was there. Everything I did was mainly on campus.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that, I think, came down to transportation.
Mm-hmm.
It was just logistically easier to do things that were on campus. I tried in the beginning, you know, said, oh, okay, let me, you know, explore what's in the area, or even try to go to a church group thing, you know, from the church that my family was going to at the time. But I found it to be an incredible production to try to go and do those things that were not immediately in the surrounding area. So I ended up just focusing on what happened on campus as its own kind of town or community.
Okay. I think you alluded to this a little bit earlier, or to some facet of it, but how do you remember race relations on campus while you were there?
Oh, I remember quite well race relations on campus. I'll say that it, at the very least, was complicated.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I had several rude awakenings while I was on campus. I growing up in Silver Spring, it's one of the most diverse places just in the United States, mm-hmm. period. And so what that meant for me is that I had grown up and I was used to being around people of different races who were used to being around other people of different races. So, for example, the white people that I knew, you know, they were used to being around Black, Latino, Asian, Native American folks. And usually, you know, if they said something a little untoward, they knew they were doing it, you know, versus just kind of being ignorant or not caring. But for the most part, there was this sense of, you just should know about other people. Or, you know, there wasn't a profound ignorance of histories and other people's present day experiences. So I'm not saying it was a total utopia, mm-hmm. but I'm setting that up as the comparison for what I found when I went to University of Maryland. And I think I very naively assumed that because the university was physically located in Prince George's County, which we know is predominantly Black and Brown, mm-hmm. and because College Park is really not that far from Silver Spring, and because I had been on campus as a visitor in earlier when I talked about these 6 years of this very intense STEM program, well, I would go to the McKeldin Library as a middle schooler or a high schooler to do research for what I had to do for school, which mm-hmm. is not usual. You know, when I got on campus, the undergraduate library, of course, is Hornbeck, and McKeldin mm-hmm. is a graduate library. Well, I was used to that. And I was used to, like I said, the visitor. I was used to being there as a visitor. And I said, oh, this is great. But when I came as a student, I found one of the rude awakenings was, like I said, interactions with students who were not used to being around people of other races, and also didn't necessarily value that as a thing to do, or as a norm, as a place of balance, and felt empowered to just say anything whenever. I've never liked the onus, the social onus that I feel is put on us as Black and Brown people to be accommodating and tolerate and understand all these microaggressions. I didn't mean anything by it, you know, and that we're somehow supposed to be calm and non-reactive and just brush it off. Why can't they do something different? Mm-hmm. So that was one of my first rude awakenings when I came to campus. And some of the stuff was like the usual, you're probably gonna guess what I'm gonna say. Can I touch your hand? No, not even. Just, you know, the reach in. There's some who ask, but ones that just, I'm like, if you don't get out my hair, how does it do like that? Okay, it's in twists. So there's gravity now, but when it's not in twists, there's anti-gravity that happens, right? We know this. Mm-hmm. Just reach all in there and do stuff. And, you know, my first roommate, I remember coming out the shower, because of course there's a million of us, one bathroom, you know, on the floor. Mm-hmm. And the first week of school, why isn't your hair wet? Why would my hair be wet? Well, you took a shower and you didn't wash your hair. Well, I washed it yesterday. Well, why didn't you wash it today? Well, why would I wash it today? She's like, well, isn't that nasty? I said, rule number one, most Black people don't wash their hair every day. Mm-hmm. It's too dry for that. It's just, we're dealing with a different texture and scalp and stuff. And then there's the, you know, look down your nose judgment that goes with that. Mm-hmm. I didn't go to college to be judged as being unclean. And I didn't go to college to have to give lessons about everything Black or just not white mm-hmm. to white people. I didn't go to college to have to defend myself for doing regular stuff. But that's what I found was part of the college experience. So there's the stuff like that that's just, you know, annoying. And then there's the stuff that's more blatant, more, you know, that I found more deeply cutting. Mm-hmm. For example, when I was in France, again, I had American roommates, you know, four mm-hmm. of us in one apartment, a two-bedroom apartment. And when we got there, there was one student, she arrived hours before the rest of us did. So she claimed the room they were going to have. And the setup was, there was two white students, there was me, and there was another Black student. Mm-hmm. So the two white students, you know, they had already predetermined that they were going to be roommates, and the one was going to choose the room, and that was there. So they chose the nicer of the two rooms. The other student, she was a Black student for Baltimore. Mm-hmm. She and I were, you know, both on scholarship. You know, mine was academic, hers was financial aid plus, you know, Pell Grant, whatever, completely need-based. But either way, both of us were completely on scholarship. Mm-hmm. And and I do very distinctly remember feeling like I was being treated as an outsider in my own apartment by the other two girls. Mm-hmm. That was also, I think, my first experience with a sense of their sense of entitlement all up in my face. I know you know what I mean, but mm-hmm. I'm just going to clarify it for whoever's watching this later.
Definitely.
What I mean by that is, it is not uncommon for whoever is in the majority or the empowered group in a situation to feel entitled to do or say certain things, feel entitled to receive a certain treatment, feel entitled to treat other people a certain way, especially people who do not share that majority status. Mm-hmm. It is not uncommon to find people in the majority to put down or cast aspersions on what might be the disenfranchised group or the marginalized group. And I understood technically this concept especially, you know, coming from Black families on both sides, you know, my mother's side and my father's side, both, you know, Black families. But I think most people who are other, whatever that is, it could be racial, it could be gender identity, it could be whatever, but most people who are the other, I think most of us have a moment where it really switches from the conceptual to a very kind of soul twisting experience where it's just really in your face. You're mm-hmm. like, oh, this is happening to me right now. It's not just one of those family folktale, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when you're younger, the 16, 17, 18, listen, we all thought we knew almost everything. I mean, we know this.
Mm-hmm.
So here I was 20, and I'm like, oh, you know, so I'm in this apartment with these girls, and I'm a person who doesn't, I don't mince words about my identity.
Mm-hmm.
I don't walk around with a billboard, but I, you know, it's just however it flows in regular conversation is what it is. I don't feel the need to or think it's appropriate to somehow water it down or shift that based on who is in my presence.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember early on living in the apartment, and naturally to get to know each other, what do you do? tell me about where you're from. Tell what's your major? What's, you know, like in college, like that's your occupation. What's your major? Then that somehow defines who you are and whatever. You know, why are you here? Whatever. But I'll never forget it. It was early on in the school year. Maybe we've been there. I don't even know if it was a whole month, but the two white students who were in the apartment, who kind of, you know, they clicked off to themselves. They did a lot of clicking off themselves. Mm-hmm. But they said to me one day, hey, could we talk to you in the living room? I said, yeah, okay. I was naive. I thought they wanted to hang out, get to know each other a little better. So they sat down together and I was over here. And they said, we got a question for you. It's something we don't understand. I said, what is it? Is it a French thing? I was the strongest French. Mm-hmm. I was the only one in the apartment who was completely fluent. Mm-hmm. Like, is it a French thing? Is it a culture thing? Is it a, you know, something you don't get from the university? Like, what is it? They said, well, we don't understand why it is that you think you're Black. I said, excuse me? They said, I mean, yeah, like you say that. They're like, but look at you. You're like almost the same color we are. And I had to pause because I wasn't, not only was that not where I thought this was headed, mm-hmm. but I felt in that moment like I had to rebound and catch my emotional breath, mm-hmm. as it were. Because again, a lot of us on the outside, you know, whether it's, again, because of color, race, religion, whatever it is, we know that there's this, however we respond, whatever we do, especially if it's in communication with someone who's not used to being around whatever slice or group or whatever we represent in that moment, that they're the type who take it as, oh, this is, you know, mm-hmm. if you get angry, all Black people are angry, you know, or if it's a, I've had this conversation with many of my Muslim friends. They're like, if I react in any way that's not, you know, calm, then it's like, oh, you know, people are just going to think that, you know, all Muslim people are angry, you know, and that's not true.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, when you're other, you carry the burden of all the stereotypes that you didn't create, but that are in other people's minds. Mm-hmm. The other thing that struck me in that moment is that I had never had anybody be so bold as to just say it like that. I'd been used to being teased growing up for being of a lighter complexion. I didn't like it, but that's also different from someone just trying to remove that complete racial identity. Mm-hmm. So I look at that as kind of a setup to how that year went, because it didn't start and stop with that moment. Then later, my roommate, the other Black student, she was from Baltimore, she was telling me she was out with several students from the university. The group that came from University of Maryland was mostly white. Mm-hmm. And we were a cohort, but we were also integrated into the general, you know, University of Nice student mm-hmm. body for a lot of things. And then for our courses, we were divided up by level. Some mm-hmm. of us who came over, we were already fluent. Others were in different levels of emerging fluency. So, you know, I didn't have any classes with my roommates. Mm-hmm. So academically, some of our experiences were very different, but most of the American students who came over were in classes with them. They were in the kind of emerging lower levels, you know. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really, you know, see too many of them during the day and stuff. But evidently they were all sitting around a group of them. And it was really a thing. And they said to my roommate, they said, "We don't understand. Why does Halima think she's Black?" And so my roommate says to them, she said, "Well, you know, she's got two Black parents. Like, she's, mm-hmm. you have Black families that are just, we range in color."
Right.
And they said, yeah, but her color though, like why doesn't she like claim her whiteness? Yeah, my face did what yours did. Right. So she comes back and tells me this, and I said, "Why is this a whole thing? And how are they ignorant that we don't come in different colors? Well, I have to go back to roots and talk about how you can, like, how you had rape and slavery and intermixing of colors, and generations later, you can have somebody who's not biracial, but just light-skinned." That was evidently a foreign concept, even though it was part of American history. And so I said to them, "But why are they all confused about this?" I said, "My mom came." I said, "She's Black and we're, you know, about mm-hmm. the same color." And she said, "Oh, that didn't help. That seemed to just make it more confusing." I said, "Listen, why should I be responsible for the fact that they are so ignorant to our American interworkings and culture?" Mm-hmm. I was like, "They can be on this new age all they want to." I said, "But the grandmother I was just talking about, who mm-hmm. is from Southern Maryland, we're the same color. We have similar phenotypes. We look alike. Listen, it didn't stop segregation. It's not, mm-hmm. if we could be segregated together, then we can be Black together. I don't know. I know different states have different things they teach or whatever, but this was a hard, it was a hard concept." And I remember feeling incredibly resentful that was part of my study abroad experience. I didn't leave the United States to then go abroad to be immersed in more racial politics than I was used to dealing with when I was actually on University of Maryland's campus. Mm. So, you know, that's kind of how that year went. There was a lot of, that whole year was filled with both microaggressions and just overt aggressions. And like I said, not just by one or two students. So I didn't hang out so much with most of the American students over there. Most of my friends were either other European students from other countries who were in a way outsiders, you know, or French, actual French students enrolled at the university, but who were not European. Actual French students, but whose families were North African or West African, mm-hmm. or Reunion Island or Martinique and Guadeloupe, or, you know, mm-hmm. some derivative of colonization. And I realized later that while I had a lot of, again, French friends, mm-hmm. I didn't have very many white French friends. And I realized that everyone that I clicked with was an outsider in their own way, with their own stories. And that's where I felt settled. And I also think that the negative and racially biased experiences that I was having with the American students affected my interest in exploring relationships with the white French students. Mm-hmm. Because in my mind, it was like, it was probably too much to separate. So that's kind of how that year went.
And so these study abroad students, I know you mentioned one was from a different institution that was your roommate.
Mm-hmm.
Was this cohort that you came with mostly UMD students or all mm-hmm. except that one?
No, it was mainly UMD students. There were a couple others that were from different institutions, but the majority were University of Maryland College Park students.
So would you say that some of the racial climate at UMD followed you to France?
Yeah, I would definitely say that. I would definitely say that. And I feel like in my first 2 years, I wasn't ignorant to things, but I didn't have as much in my face as living just in that apartment. Like when I was in the dorm, you know, the dorms are huge.
Mm-hmm.
And so like my first year, I had a white roommate. You know, I was telling you about why mm-hmm. isn't my hair washed and why isn't this? And every day is a different question. But I just had to sleep in my room. I mean, I could go hang out in anybody's room. And so it didn't bother me the same way. I think there was more a sense of, I think there was a larger ability to escape. You know, in the dorm, I didn't have to study in my room. I could study in the lounge. I could go in the computer lab. I could, you know, read at the dining hall. I could whatever. When I was in France, my apartment was not near campus. My apartment, about a 40-minute walk
okay.
to the campus. So I only went to campus for class. When my class was done, that was it, you know, unless I had specifically made plans to hang out with somebody maybe who lived in the dorms or, you know, do something, you know, in the university cafeteria or whatever. I didn't have a cell phone. There wasn't, you know, it was kind of like whatever I happened to coordinate. Otherwise, I was in my apartment, and I got to a point where I said, why do I have to leave my apartment? Why do I have to leave my building to feel comfortable? This is just wrong. And I was unhappy and resentful about that. The year I came back to, in my narrative of my 4 years at Maryland,
mm-hmm.
there was, let's just say, like the entry level, racism and microaggressions, and, you know, some of the surprise by other students, like, oh, you're talented at this, or oh, you're know,
so
the way
well
some
spoken.
People, yeah, so well, so clean and articulate, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Or if I excelled at something, especially in the language classes, oh, you must be, you can't be just Black American, you have to be some kind of, you must be half French, you must be. As if somehow we can't achieve by virtue of just, I don't know, studying and being intelligent. Other people can, but I don't know, somehow the stereotype doesn't prevent that from being true. It was at this level in my first 2 years, but it increased, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then when I went to France, it went up to here. And then when I came home, by the time I came home, I was so angry. I was very, very angry. Just in general. And I was a lot more deliberate about who I wanted to spend my time with, what I wanted to talk about. You know, I was really done with the whole like kumbaya, meet and explore people. Mm-hmm. The year I came back, that's when it really escalated. Rachman Culver, who I mentioned earlier in this interview in terms of his founding of the Saturday Freedom Schools program, mm-hmm. And his I'll just say rejuvenation of the Black Explosion mm-hmm. newspaper. It was like borderline defunct, kind of. It wasn't producing very much beforehand. You know, I know has also been interviewed as part of this.
Well, I'll interview him tomorrow.
Oh, okay, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'll let him get into details about his story, but mm-hmm. in so much as we overlap, because we did get married after college, you know, mm-hmm. we'd known each other from middle school, high school, college, we got married, we're still married. 19 years later, we have 3 teenagers. Mm-hmm. So I say that to preface how much some of our narratives will overlap for the final part of college. Mm-hmm. What I'm about to talk about is a big part of his narrative, but it affected me. Okay. So in that last year, he and I worked on, like I said, different organizations together, and then we had our separate stuff. Mm-hmm. But those were the two where we overlapped a lot. And then we naturally spent a lot of time together. And so in the first semester, he experienced something that I found profoundly traumatizing. And it was 1,000% racial. Mm-hmm. He received a series of racially motivated death threats in the first semester. And it was not handled well by the police or the university. And in fact, the biggest investigator of that was my brother, who at the time was a computer science major mm-hmm. and was profoundly well-versed at all things internet. So he was able to provide a lot of information to the police about some of the origins of, you know, where in the internet this was coming from. Mm-hmm. And the university was even able to track down what computer lab, you know, mm-hmm. they came from. But amazingly, they just never knew who did it. Even though they tracked it down to the lab and the computer, and we all know you have to sign in to be able to use a computer. So anyway, I don't want to take that narrative from him, mm-hmm. but in so much as, like I said, we were really close. We had already talked about getting married, you know, after we graduated, mm-hmm. you know, being so close to him and being there, you know, while he was going through this, the ways that he was threatened were graphic. And I, when you talk about race at the university, that is part of that umbrella of experiences of unsavory experiences during the 4 years that I was there. And I kind of see that as you said, the racial stuff followed me from University of Maryland to France. And then it's like, just here, pass the torch. And it just it continued. I have memories of all 4 years of racial something. Even in class, even in the dance program, which I loved, when it came to the courses where you had a lot of individual expression, not like, you know, modern dance or ballet or jazz, where it's like, okay, do your routine, do your warm-ups, and then you are going to just work out the choreography that the teacher has given to you. Mm-hmm. But in the choreography classes, or, you know, some of the other improv or what have you, where you as the student are generating original content, original product, what I chose to choreograph or create, just like in a creative writing piece, you know, it was born out of personal experience, personal interest, personal curiosities. So a lot of my pieces had a lot of, I'll say ethnic qualities, for lack of a better word. And I remember during peer evaluation, you know, we give comments about stuff before. Whoever's the professor of that class gives the overall, you know, comments. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of, I want to say a lot of the criticism that came from my peers was steeped in my choreography being culturally different. Mm-hmm. Because I did not stick to the classical Eurocentric ballet oriented or modern ballet oriented line of movement. Or, you know, dance pieces all have a narrative. They're telling a story. And I did not tell Eurocentric stories in those pieces. And I'll never forget, this was a class, one of these classes I'm talking about was where Alvin Mays, like mm-hmm. I said, who's still, he's leading the dance department now. I remember he spoke up for me in a way that no teacher had ever done. And he said, he criticized the students for criticizing me for sharing an ethnic experience that they didn't understand. The majority of the students were white females. Mm-hmm. You had a couple, I can count on some fingers, students of color, but the overwhelming majority were white students. They do dance since they were little. They trained in ballet. That was the right way mm-hmm. to dance. And so in that class, they learned that not to attack me that way, but to actually look at the choreography. And if they didn't have anything constructive to say about the choreography, don't say anything. And I realized how much he protected me in that class by making that statement, because in the next class, next choreography with the same group of girls, it's like they let out the things they could not say. Mm-hmm. I had a white professor. She was very talented in terms of her eye for dance and communication. But she said nothing to any of those girls for the same statements they were making. So they had a free-for-all. And I remember one day, we were supposed to be, you know, we had free time to choreograph and we could go into different studios or hallways or whatever. Mm-hmm. I just left. I found Alvin, I sat in his rocking chair and I told him how painfully miserable I was in that class and how I was so tired of the underhanded culture-based comments. And I said, I refuse to change and I refuse to adopt a completely Eurocentric whitewashed style of choreography. Could I dance that way? Yes, but this was my chance to make my dance narratives. And he's like, you shouldn't. I said, but they're brutal. They are brutal. I said, and I thank you for protecting me when I was in your class or getting a handle on that. I said, but this other teacher, no. And he still remembers that story to this day because we still talk, but the racial challenges from going to University of Maryland, they were small and they were big. They were subtle and they were obvious. They were interwoven throughout all facets of the experience, dorm, cafeteria, in class itself, extracurriculars, study abroad. And so they are so meticulously woven in that I cannot talk and reflect on my experience at the university without automatically thinking about any number of racial politics or dynamics or, you know, the anger, the resentment, the fear, the intimidation, ferocity, and disappointment. So I think of it as a bittersweet experience.
To shift just a little, but to also touch on something you mentioned earlier.
Sure.
What do you remember of campus activities during your time at UMD, such as concerts, speakers, parties?
Oh, yeah.
Things
I can speak to that. There was something for everybody. I really want to say that. Even though Black students were a minority at Maryland, we still are, I think, an even smaller one than when I was there.
Yes.
Because the university is so huge, though, mm-hmm. if you skip the percentages and you actually take just the number of students, it's enough to do stuff. It's mm-hmm. enough to have a step show, you know, it's enough to have some parties. It's enough to, you know, it's enough to congregate and feel like you can have moments where you're surrounded by other people like you. Mm-hmm. So I do have fond memories of parties at the student union. I went to the Black Student Union parties. I went to the Caribbean Student Association parties. I went to the Latino Student Union parties. Different music at all three parties. And I loved all of it. I went to the step shows. Made me very happy. And I appreciate those things because you have several predominantly white institutions where we just don't constitute a big enough number to pull those things off, especially a step show. So I look at those as respites, you know, in the sea of complication in some words. There were also C Productions put on a Art Attack every year, which mm-hmm. I look forward to. I don't know if that still takes place, but there was a free concert. There were different activities. One year for Art Attack, there was the Roots, you know, another year it was George Clinton, P-Funk All-Stars, you know, things like that. However, while I was excited to go to concerts like that, you know, that were put on that were free, and I was excited, you know, that it's like, yes, okay, something that's, you know, it's got some ethnicity to it. As a female, on the other hand, there's the trade-off, because as a Black student, I was excited. As a female student, I wanted to be excited. However, there was, every time I went, there was a 100% chance of getting groped or, you know, verbally encountered in a way that was very sexually unsavory. What 100% chance, and not just of one incident, of like kind of throughout the night.
Mm-hmm.
So I also looked at, remember those with mixed emotion? Again, excited. There's this opportunity to go see the Roots. But also, you know, my female friends, it's like we'd gear up for like sexual harassment for the evening, or like gear up for, you know, being molested for the, you know, just trying to do our own things. Trying to like stay away from guys, you know, and still there's that part of the experience that I feel like, as far as campus culture, it's like, oh, well, that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Do you think, so with you being a part of C, were those kind of conversations had when there was discussion about who to bring to campus? Or do you think kind of race superseded gender?
Yeah, I don't think so. I really think the focus was like on, okay, well, what form of entertainment can we put together? Not like what happens in the crowd, unless it was mm-hmm. viewed as a security issue, right? And by security, not the female students getting felt up. I don't think that counted as security,
right. But like
fights or unruly shoving and put, you know, mm-hmm. like what would have been considered a physical threat to safety, just not to females, you know, but just from a perhaps more of a patriarchal definition of what was a physical threat to safety. And I don't think that was like C specific. I just
mm-hmm.
think culture wide, like, well, you know.
Because in looking through the school newspapers, I mean, I've spent a considerable amount of time going through Eclipse and going through Black Explosion mm-hmm. and some Diamondback. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if in planning the, because there's always trying to get to the sweet spot of investing money into bringing someone who's also going to want to be enjoyed and also generate money as well. But I wonder if there was thought put into not how the crowd would react, but the kinds of acts that might incite that, not just that it was a crowd of people mm-hmm. and therefore things happen.
I understand. I really don't know the answer to that question. I'm not sure, and I know that I wasn't focused on it at the mm-hmm. time. Yeah, I think there was a certain, or at least I'll speak for myself, you know, as upset as I was, I also think that there was a certain sense of complacency, like, oh, this is just how it is, like, there's going to be weed, you're going to smell it, it's going to be in the air, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be people drinking, there's just going to be, so it's like, gear up to go into that zone. Not, why does it have to be like that? That wasn't as obvious a thought pattern as maybe that seems. I wasn't thinking about it that way. It was more like a survival mode than like a proactive mm-hmm. Philosophical kind of a thing.
Definitely.
Since you mentioned the Diamondback, you know, and speaking to some kind of racial stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I was at Maryland at the same time Aaron Magruder was at Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, Boondocks was just this comic strip that ran in the school newspaper, usually in the Diamondback, sometimes in the Black explosion, but like early in my first 2 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
And everybody loved the Boondocks. It was amazing. I used to bring home issues of the Diamondbacks so my brother could read it while he was in high school. I was like, this is the funny best thing. You gotta read this, right? We all know how that turned out.
Right.
But I'll never forget, there was one issue where the Diamondback messed up. They messed up Aaron's comic strip some kind of way. And rather than in his block print, due to publisher error or something, we cannot run this, you know, they printed like the Boondocks, his name, and then like an empty strip with just the words, oops. And so a lot of people had interpreted it the same way. Like, wait, did Aaron mess up the cartoon? Did he just not do one for this week? Because like I said, Boondocks, Aaron McGrew, and the thing. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what happened? The Diamondback is what happened. Mm-hmm. So he pulled it. He's like, that's it. This is disrespectful. And I remember, I was like, no, I love the Boondocks. But then I was like, good for you. Mm-hmm. Because at least somebody's not taking it. At least somebody is standing up to, you know, some of this foolishness that happens.
Definitely. Well, this kind of, we've talked about this, I think, a little bit. Do you mm-hmm. remember any campus protests during your time at UMD?
Kind of. I'll qualify that. In my first 2 years, to be honest, I just don't remember. There might have been between 96 and 98, but I just don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
In 98 to 99, when I was in France, with the French, there's always a protest. So when I think of protests, almost all of them in my mind are taking place there. The high school mm-hmm. students went on strike, college students, bus drivers, train drivers, just like pick your week and there's strike. But culturally, that's normal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Coming back to University of Maryland, the biggest one that stands out in my mind is I can't remember exactly when, but maybe January-ish, early, okay. You probably want to fact check my timing, but sometime mm-hmm. maybe between December and January. I think of it as like cold weather months, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it was around that time. There was some form of student protest around the death threats situation, but it was not in response to the first set that Rahman received, because that was one of those university wants to sweep it under the carpet thing. And so people knew about it, but there was not a tension. CBS sent a news crew down to do a story about it. And you can still find it online. And I'm sure Rahman will talk about all of this. But as far as the campus was concerned, it was amazingly mute.
Mm-hmm.
And so then later in the window I'm talking about, there was like one set of death threats that targeted a handful of Black leaders on campus, like the leader of the BSU, and Rahman was the editor-in-chief of the mm-hmm. you know, Black Explosion and Saturday Freedom Schools, and there were a couple others. And that generated some protest-ish, it generated some activity on mm-hmm. campus. Whether we use the word protest, but it generated
demonstration.
Yes, it generated some form of demonstration on campus. The issue with that, and he'll probably talk about it tomorrow, is that there were a lot of really sketchy circumstances surrounding that one, and it wasn't at all graphic, like what happened in the fall. Like, and then there was also some question of validity of that one. The other ones were for real. This one was like, was it really a thing, or was it something somebody was doing to be able to generate a protest,
Like in the
which
grain of the Willie Lynch letter.
something like that. I'm just, and so then it's like, well, no, thank you. Like, what did this accomplish? So, but that's kind of the biggest thing that I remember in terms of activism to an extent that generated attention, or that spoke to a scale that was not small. I remember when I entered as a freshman, hearing about rapes, that happen on campus, right? In TAWS, in whatever, or and the response was like, oh man, stuff happens, you girls should be careful. Not like, hey, why don't we change school culture? It was not that kind of stuff. And the biggest thing related to that, I remember garnering attention, was like, there was some guy who thought it would be funny to sneak into the girls' bathroom, and then was like in the shower or something. And this one girl noticed, she's like, I think there's a guy next door because those legs are way too hairy to be a female. I remember that as somehow the distinguishing thing. And then, getting the RA, and they were like, oh, and the guy's like, I thought it would be a prank. And then I don't even know what happened with that, but it was so, I don't know, stuff like that was so profoundly underwhelming in whatever happened.
And I think you've also talked on this a little bit as well with McKeldin Hall,
Library.
Mall. But are there physical spaces on campus where you felt m really welcome and really comfortable? And were there spaces that you didn't?
A good question. In terms of, so McKeldin Mall, I love to walk through, but I was not the type to stop and just spend time on the mall. I would go for long walks. I might walk for 30 minutes around the campus, but I stayed moving. I didn't really stay in one spot if I was outside. McKeldin Mall at the time, there are people who use the mall, but in terms of spending time on it when it was outdoors, I remember that being mostly the white students, either sunbathing or playing frisbee. I liked the McKeldin Library for the research, for academic, for getting my homework done, because it was quiet. Hornbeck Library, they nicknamed it something like Horny Bake. I mean, it was the place. If people who studied in Hornbeck Library, it was like a social scene to be hit on or to do fake homework. kind of looked like you were doing homework enough to somebody to, it was, study dates happened there. Like, I figured that out very quickly. I just went back to McKeldin. If I was going to the library, I wanted to find some books and do some work. That's why I was in college. So I felt comfortable there in so much as being a serious student, but there was nothing profoundly inviting about the library, other than, you know, I knew if I went there, I wasn't going to get hit on. So that's where I went to do some work. Places I hung out, I want to say in the student union. I know the student union's gone through renovations over the last couple of decades. But at the time, you know, there was the lounge. There was a student lounge, and off of it, you had the BSU office and the LSU office. And, you know, there were several student group offices. So in and around that area, either some offices were bigger than others. Some, you know, you could accommodate like a couch and people sitting around, you know, talking, and others, they were tinier and you kind of used that lounge space. I remember playing a lot of spades, a lot. I'm just being honest. It was a lot and it was serious. I remember being late to several classes because I had to finish my spades game. I'm not saying that was responsible. I'm just saying that it was culturally significant. So I want to say that's probably where I spent most of my free time during the regular week. I wasn't there on the weekends, but, you know, because you had commuter students and other stuff. And but that was definitely, I knew I could go in there and at some point find a spades game.
Okay. And a spades game would be in the student union broadly or around those offices?
No, in the lounge that was near those offices.
Okay.
Because, well, I'm gonna be honest, I don't think I played spades with anybody who wasn't Black. So it was, I'm being honest.
I never have either.
I don't think in life, you know, I'm 43. I really don't think so. So in that lounge area, like I said, between the Caribbean students, the Black students, whatever, you just in there, it was going to be a table, some chairs, some whatever, and there was spades. So that's, I had a lot of happy moment memories playing spades in between classes or whatever. So that was definitely one place. What else? I want to say in my first 2 years in the high-rise dorm I lived in, it was hot. Yes, there was no AC, cinder block walls. It was all the way out on the edge of campus. But there were so many people in the building and in the quad, you know, the other dorms right there, that it was really easy to, like, you know, find people to hang out with. You just appear and there's somebody to hang out with or play cards or something. Talk trash, you know. So I think those are probably maybe my two fondest memories of spaces. Otherwise, in my very last year, I spent a lot of time in the Black Explosion office. Like a lot of time there, especially if it was a weekend where the issue went to print, which is, you know, every other weekend, then we would spend like 24 hours split between. It was a lot of doing all the final edits, all the layout, getting everything ready for the printer, courier, etc. And so I have fond memories of that space too, because I was so excited that the paper was running on a regular basis. You know, before it was like kind of like when it happened to come out, you never knew if when there was going to be an issue. So I was excited that it was running on a regular basis, and I was excited about the stories that were in it, because they were voices and stories that were not reflected in the Diamondback. So from a community contribution standpoint, you know, I have fond memories of that space, even though the hours were grueling on the weekends when the issue would come out. I would say that's probably my biggest fondest memories. And even though I spent a lot of time in the dance department, there was a lot of mixed emotion tied up there. But I also really liked being there when I found times or studios I could use alone to just move or choreograph or reflect. That like that was my happy meditative spot. I was never very involved. As many language classes as I took, and I had, as a French major, I had 69 French credits. That's a lot, you know, I know, for an undergrad. So as many, and that was just the French, that didn't include the Spanish, that didn't include the, you know, dance or whatever. But I didn't hang out with the foreign language department. It was kind of like I went there for class and got out. I never really clicked with anybody in terms of professors, students, whatever. So, yeah.
Where was the Black Explosion office located? Was it in the Union?
No, it was in Nimburu Cultural Center. Pretty sure it was the lower level.
Okay. Also, I think you've spoken to this with at least a couple of professors, but are there professors or staff members who stick out to you as having been supportive or not so supportive?
Yes, both. Mm-hmm. So, to speak to that question, like I said, first and foremost, I'll say Alvin Mays again, mm-hmm. who's still there. He's wonderful. He knows my children, my husband, you know. He was very supportive while I was in the program. But, you know, sometimes you have a professor who's supportive of you in that particular discipline. Mm-hmm. And other times you have a professor who's supportive of you as a whole person. So I'll put him in that category, you know.
The whole person?
As a whole person, as well as in the discipline. And even after I graduated, when my husband and I were 27, we danced in a piece as part of a showcase that Alvin was putting on, called La Familia. It was at Dance Place in the city, and he choreographed a duet, and he said to me, we were 28. So when I was 27, he said to me, he's like, I have this duet in mind that I want you and your husband to do. And I said, and at the time I just had a baby. I was like, look at me. He said, oh, you have a year, so figure it out. I said, okay. So, you know, I reconditioned myself back into, you know, dancer shape, mm-hmm. and we did this piece, and had a lot of fun performing it. It was a two-night show, mm-hmm. But so he was really supportive, and also, as I mentioned, Mim Rosen, mm-hmm. She was in the department a long time. I want to say into her 80s, she was still teaching dance. She was supportive of me as a young artist, as a person who was culturally inquisitive, who enjoyed travel and language. We got to a point, however, in my last year where I feel like there's a little bit of a cultural divide, mm-hmm. and I I chose to pursue my dance studies at Maryland because of her. And she would push me to do auditions. That's how I ended up performing with the Maryland Dance Ensemble. She pushed me to try things outside of my comfort zone. She pushed me. Sometimes it was a setup. She pushed me. She's like, I want you to do this thing, you know, on my own time. I was like, sure, I always did it. One time she sent me to a masterclass, mm-hmm. West African dance. It was wonderful, but it was a masterclass. And I was not at that level. I was like, what did you just set me up for? But the point is, she always pushed me to these experiences. But in my last year, like I said, after I come back from France, and I was very angry about a lot of things. And race and culture was on my mind all the time, kind of inextricably from anything else. And I think we got to a point where, like, in conversation, we just couldn't. We kind of had to go like this, kind of veer off from each other a little bit. So that was something that I had to reconcile about this person who kind of helped push me, you know, up to that point. And we did keep in touch even after I graduated. The third person who comes to mind in terms of really supportive professors is Madeline Haig, H-A-G-E is her last name, Madeline Haig. And she was she's native French born, but has lived most of her life here. You know, she came here as a younger adult, got married, and, you know, lived more time in the U.S. than France. But she was the accompanying professor from University of Maryland on the University of Nice trip for the year. It was 1 year she was there. And so she was also the teacher of the course, the concurrently enrolled course that showed up on our transcript as UMD French, whatever, mm-hmm. whatever numbers they were. So we took the course with her, but it was different from in a regular sitting. The course we took each semester from her, it wasn't in a classroom, it was in her apartment. So the living room, dining room combo is where we would all kind of sit to take this course. Some of us on the couch, some on the floor, some on the dining room table, you know, mm-hmm. it was that kind of thing. But it was a real course though. It was, you know, but the feel of it was profoundly informal just because of the mm-hmm. setting, even though the work was for real. She helped me a lot when I was there adjusting, you know, because I had a difficult time acculturating, and I didn't think that I would, because, you know, like I said, I was already fluent in French. I had known, you know, French heritage speakers my own age my whole life from different parts of the Francophone world, you know, whether they were Haitian and Francophone, North African and Francophone, West African and Francophone, Canadian and Francophone, you know, all different types of mix and Francophone. So I said, oh yeah, I'll get here, piece of cake. And I had the rude awakening that just because someone's Francophone and actual France itself are not the same thing. Mm-hmm. So there were some things that were just really hard for me to adjust to or unexpected. Because I had visited France as a visitor, but mm-hmm. like I said about Maryland, when you go as a tourist and when you go as the real person, two different experiences. So there were some things that I didn't understand. And so she helped me a lot through that. And also she and her husband were both white, you know, she's white French, her husband's white American, but they had two children that were adopted that were black. and you know, and they both spoke French and whatever. But I think in a lot of ways, temperament-wise, I was a lot like her son. And I think that helped her have a little perspective in terms of where and how I got angry with these different situations, and also trying to navigate, like, where did I fit in this new place? So we would talk outside of class, you know, plenty. And I know that she put a lot of effort into, you know, trying to help me find my way. And coincidentally enough, like about 10 years ago, so I was, I guess, 33 at the time, I found out she had retired from University of Maryland, but she was leading a French book club in Bethesda at the library. Mm-hmm. And so I went, I was doing the book club for a while. And it was fun, you know, we'd read these different French novels, discuss it and everything. So it was nice to kind of, to reconnect with her in that way. And then I ultimately stopped going, cause it was a far drive to make in rush hour from mm-hmm. where I live in Prince George's County. And at the time, my kids were all in elementary school and I was teaching, my husband was teaching, and it was just a lot. So I fell away from it. But when I think of the experience of going abroad, and when I think of people who have helped mold me, even if it's just for a season, then mm-hmm. she's one of those people that I think of.
And then what about professors who were less supportive? Do you have anything to stick out?
I'm not going to name names. I'm just going to tell you what they taught, what class I took. Mm-hmm. One more professor I forgot. Mm-hmm. He was a grad student, but it wasn't like a big class with a TA, you know, it was his own class. But this Black Lit, African American Lit, it was one of these courses that was cross-listed between the English department and the Afro-American Studies department. Seth, I can't think of his last name, but he was really, really phenomenal teacher. And also pushed me to just kind of dig in and be more reflective, both as a student and in terms of finding the intersectionality between my passion for language and Black American narrative. Mm-hmm. You know, looking at both the Harlem Renaissance and La Negritude, which mm-hmm. is the, you know, Francophone version of the Harlem Renaissance. And he also was fluent in French. He was American, you know, like me, but also fluent in French. And I remember for our final paper, because of what I was studying, or what I was writing about, comparing the two, and a lot of my sources and stuff were in French because I was pulling from La Negritude. He said, you know, if you want, you can write your final paper in French, even though it's an English class. I was like, really? He said, yeah. And if you do that, it can be shorter than the English paper. I said, okay, take it. Took the challenge. And I said, well, what do I do with quoting? He said, well, quote in whatever language the source came from, but just the quotes. I said, yeah, okay, all right. But I enjoyed opportunities where, like, a teacher would let me do something unconventional to make the stretch or growth as a student, as a person. Okay, so now for the other people.
Okay.
I had this one French teacher. I never really clicked too much with most of the French teachers I had at the University of Maryland. But I had this one French teacher. And, you know, it was a translation class. He was a British guy, completely fluent in French, you know, but a British guy. And I remember we were doing something and we were sharing our translations. And so when you're learning how to translate, sometimes they can be a little clunky, either in your native language or the target language. Mm-hmm. So my English translation was a little bit clunky, but it was, I'm kind of an unusual person in that most people have an easier time going from the target language and translating into their native language.
Mm-hmm.
I intuitively have an easier time translating into the target language than into my native language. I can't tell you why, but it just, you know, I'm built that way. But so one of them, it was a little bit clunky. And I volunteered to share what I had, right? And I'll never forget, he said in front of the whole class, and he was a, you know, some people can be just kind of a stick in the mud. Like they just, I'm like, I don't know, are you here to, well, some people you're like, why are you here?
Mm-hmm.
Why do you teach people? But anyway, so he said to me, after I volunteered to share, he said, listen, I know English isn't your first language, but you're gonna have to try a little harder to make an effort. And up till that point, I had only ever spoken French in class,
mm-hmm.
unless, you know, we had to share a piece of translation. So I switched to English, and just like this, I said, listen, I'm American. I am a native English speaker, so I don't know what you're talking about. And he said, oh. So I said to him after class, I said, why would you say that to me? And in front of the whole class, but like, why would you say that? He said, well, listen, based on your work, I figured clearly you couldn't be an English speaker. I said, seriously? That's what you're going with? And he, you know, he felt very steadfast in his, he just said that and went on to his next thing. So, you know, there's professors like that, the ones that, I don't know if they're just grumpy and they teach to picket people. I don't know. Because I wasn't the only one. I mean, there were the other people that he kind of picked mm-hmm. at, but. There was this one Spanish teacher I had in my senior year. I feel like we had kind of a contentious relationship, but I feel like it was very one-sided. And she was a grad student, you know, American. Spanish was clearly her second language. She had a little bit of American accent, you know, when she would speak and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
My Spanish accent was different from hers. It was, you know, didn't have sprinkles of American all over it and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I also found that in that class, sometimes I used vocabulary that she wasn't familiar with, because I got a lot of, why don't you share with the class what that word means? I got a lot of that regularly.
Mm-hmm.
But I also found that I didn't think she graded me like the other students. And she would do things. She would do things that I found unnecessarily challenging or inconsiderate. like, you know, we had to do presentations, and she said, okay, each person plan for like 10 minutes for your presentation. Okay. But when it was my turn and my 10, 15 minutes expired, she said, well, you know, you're the only one scheduled today and we don't really have anything planned. Why don't you just continue presenting for the rest of class? Well, you know, there's a difference between 10, 15 minutes and like 40 minutes. Mm-hmm. I did. I just kept talking because that wasn't, you know, I was fluent in Spanish also. I got a C in that class. I'm not really sure how. You know, it's not like today with this online grade book and you have, I don't know, I feel like professors back then could just feel a grade for you and then that, you know what I'm talking about?
Yep, yes. Yeah,
she just felt a grade for me. And at the end, I was like, what is this? She's like, well, in my opinion, you know, you deserve an A, but here's all the reasons that you don't have one. And they were just, it was obscure stuff. And then one of the things she said is, she's like, I have all these absences for you. I was like, I don't know how you have all those absences for me. I was here. And I said, do you have some way of documenting that I wasn't there? Because you don't have a sign-in sheet. You don't have you got an attendance roster, something. So it became one of those, you know, my word versus hers kind of things. So I found some of that, not just relegated to one department or anything, but, you know, you had some teachers who were like that. I know it's not exactly University of Maryland, but when I was in Nice through the Maryland program, we had, I'll never forget this, at our closing, we had like a closing soiree kind of an event before when the school year was over, and both our professor from University of Maryland and the professors from there, because there was this long-standing relationship, you know, between the programs. And my business teacher there, you know, we were talking, and I was with my roommate, the girl from Baltimore, she's Black. And she and I were of different complexions. She was a richer complexion. And the teacher said, oh, you know, where exactly are you each from? You know, we said, we're both from Maryland, but she's from Baltimore. I'm from like right outside DC. And she's like, oh, okay. She's like, but what are you? I was like, what do you mean, but what am I? And I said, you know, I'm American. No, but like, what are you? And I said, well, you know, I'm a Black American, like April, you know, my roommate. And she said, oh no. And she erupted into this enormous laughter. I said, why are you laughing? She's like, that was so funny, but really, what are you? And I said, I just told you what I am. And so she said, but how could that be? Look at you. Look at her. You don't look anything alike. What are you really? And that was like the end punctuation on the year. I remember sitting there thinking, of course, this just fits in with the whole, this just fits in with the year as it's gone. And I feel like in the United States, for the most part, an adult or a professor would know on some level that that's kind of taboo, even if they're thinking it. Although with recent years, people are just saying anything. But back then, people might think something, but they at least should know what not to say. And the thing is, I even kind of expected some of that kind of stuff from my peers, again, 18 to 20, whatever, that, I don't know, are exposed to nothing. You know, like my, not my first roommate, but a student who was in the French program and actually went to France with one of these Americans I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. I met her during orientation, and my dad, you know, had dropped me off campus. And later she's like, oh, where's your dad from? And I was like, Maryland. No, but his people. I was like, Calvert County. Mm-hmm. So, because like I said, from Black family, from at least, I don't know, I can trace up to the 1800s, and then, you know, it just gets a little dicey before that. But and I said, Calvert County. She's like, no, but where? Like, what? And I said, I don't know what else to tell you. And so she's like, I mean, like what's his people? You know, like I can say I'm, you know, English, and you know, somebody might say they're German and Irish. I was like, I mean, I can't tell you all that. I can just tell you he's from Maryland. And she said, why can't you? And I said, well, because he's Black, and slave owners didn't really keep all those records. And so she looked at me all offended. I guess I was fresh, but I mean, the truth is the truth. So that was like how I entered University of Maryland, day one orientation.
And then for that to be your closing event in France.
Yeah. She was there for that too, but just, you know, because what's life without a little irony? But yeah, that's, it kind of makes an arc, you know, if you put all these little dots, almost like on a graph, you know, you scatter plot these things and you just find an arc in there.
First, what year did you graduate from Maryland?
I graduated in 2000.
Okay. And did you attend graduate school? What was kind of your trajectory after that?
Oh, sure. I did end up going to graduate school, but I didn't go immediately. So I graduated in 2000. And then I got a job working as an editor. I know, where does this relate back to French? I'm going to tell you. So I look at it like this. Language is language. And having to understand its mechanics across any language and its punctuation is kind of the same skill set. But when I was working on the Black Explosion newspaper, I realized how much I really liked editing and helping craft stories. And I didn't want to generate original content, but I like fixing up somebody else's, and I liked conceiving of the whole arc of a publication. And I said, you know, I think this is something that I want to do. And if I can fit in another language in there, that's great. But if not, this is something that I want to do for now. And then, and I did, I still volunteered with the Freedom Schools program. So I still got that, you know, that outlet. And I really like working with kids. So I worked as an editor for 3 years. But so I started that job in 2000 and 2001 when Rahman graduated. We got engaged like right after he graduated. Then in 2002, we got married. Then in 2003, which is accounts for the 3 years when I left the publishing job, our oldest daughter was born in 2003. So after she was born and maternity leave, then I quit my job to stay home. But then here comes the language back around. I got 2 part-time jobs. We would kind of like high five and hand off the kid, right? He worked during the day, I was home during the day. But I got a job teaching 2 nights a week at a GED program through Montgomery College. And also I got a job on the weekend teaching French and Spanish at the U.S. Senate Page Program. So during the week, I was teaching English and math. On the weekend, I was teaching French and Spanish. And I enjoyed it, and it allowed. We ended up having 3 kids in 4 years, so they're like boom, 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 stair step. So I was like home, during the day through that time. But after, let's see. So that was 2003 is when I left working full time and started teaching part time. And in 2006, at that time we had 2 kids. They were 3 and 1. He and I both went to grad school in the same year. So he worked full time and I was home with the kids. And then he went to school in the evenings and on the weekends at George Mason. And I went to school on different evenings than he was in school at Johns Hopkins. And I got my master's in writing. And I started that program in 2006 and I graduated in 2010. What happened was 2006, in 2007, in that summer, our third daughter was born. So then I didn't take courses in the summer and I didn't take courses in that first semester. And then I started again in that. So when she was 5 months old, then I went back to taking classes in the evening. So I was on that 4-year plan. And I did that because I thought about going back into publishing, working in publishing after I was done being home with the kids. But I still, that whole time, kept teaching foreign language at the Senate through until 2011, when my youngest one started pre-K. Then everybody was in school. And I said, I don't know if I want to go back to the traditional 9 to 5. Like, I want to do something that's flexible enough so that we don't have to, so that it's easy to keep up with the kids and have a home life balance. So I started teaching. So I found a job at a local private school and I started teaching from there. But I still did, but what I ended up doing then was a shift. I was teaching during the day, but I was freelancing. So I did freelance writing, freelance graphic design, freelance editing, stuff, on my schedule. And of course, I had more time in the summers and things like that. And I would publish some articles and stuff. So that kind of let me have my hand in all the things that I loved. The English and also the language, because at the private school I was teaching French and Spanish.
Okay. And so are you a teacher now?
In spirit, but not in hours. So what happened to me was in 2014, I got hurt at work. I fell down the stairs in side of the school building, and I injured half the exact half of my body, and I haven't been able to work full time ever since. So what I did after that was I shifted to doing tutoring in all of the areas, the writing, English language arts, French, Spanish, whatever the areas that I was in. But in a schedule that I could control my disabilities. And then I continued doing the freelancing. And again, in a schedule that I could control, because if I'm from home, then, I don't have to worry about, well, can I drive today? Can I, tolerate that, what's my pain level? So I've done a combination of that ever since.
Okay. What has, this is our sort of closing question.
Sure.
What would you do, how would you describe your relationship with UMD since your graduation?
I would say, okay, well, I don't go back for any homecoming, anything. Like, I really don't go back for any events except for Maryland Day, but, you know, Corona, I haven't seen Maryland Day in a couple of springs, but that's something that I enjoyed going back to as a family every year. And I enjoy visiting the campus not affiliated with any department or thing, but just as a place. And our kids, I mentioned before, our kids are 18, 16, and 14. So the 18-year-old is in college. She's going to a Rochester Institute of Technology. But our kids have heard the Maryland stories, you know, their whole lives. And they have positive associations with the campus because, you know, it's fun. There's Maryland Day. Their parents went there. You know, their uncle went there. This is my brother. And they've seen the fun, you know, the ice cream from the dairy and all the fun stuff, right? And also, though, they know about all these other painful stories that we have. But for me, outside of all that, it's the place where I fell in love with my husband. And it's also a place that my children know their whole lives. So that's also part of the narrative. But again, it's my relationship with that is kind of on my terms. Like I don't get all hyped up because there's some kind of Maryland event. I don't have the car magnet. I'm not part of the alumni association. I don't go to the football games. I don't, you know, I don't feel like I have a relationship with the institution in that way, but I have a relationship in so much as what it represents for me. Or, you know, I've gone back to see performances at CSPAC, Clarice Smith Performing Arts Center. And like I said, I still keep in touch with Alvin Mays. My kids know him. They've been all up in his office touching stuff, you know, as grown up. So that, I guess that probably better defines my my relationship with the university or the space, the physical space.
Okay. I want to thank you for taking the time to share some of your stories with me in this oral history interview. That was my last question. Did you have any parting words for current or future UMD students?
Oh, sure.
Like words of support or...
I would say my biggest thought or piece of advice is to navigate the University of Maryland experience with a very sober lens, a lens of clarity, understanding that you can acquire a phenomenal education at the University of Maryland. It's well resourced as far as public institutions go, but always keep in mind you got to pay for that, and you got to pay for that in addition to your tuition with a certain sense of grit, self-confidence, comfort in your skin, and the fortitude to navigate some of the racial challenges that will happen, not if or when, they will. But I think that understanding that and generating a sense of cope ahead, mm-hmm. instead of kind of being blindsided in a naive bliss, can really help influence the overall social emotional component of this academic experience.
Okay, thank you so much. If I end up having additional questions, is it okay to email you?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time and your sort of, I really appreciate the thoroughness with which you went into your stories. Because I read, like I said, quite a bit about some things in Black Explosion and some of the other student newspapers. And you really gave a rich contextualization to some of what I was seeing.
Oh, thank you.
And I really appreciate that.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, if you have any questions after the fact, you know where to find me. I am happy to be candid, however candid you want me to be. Mm-hmm. And I'm excited that this project is happening.
Thank you. I'm excited about it as well. I'm happy to see us getting to the point of doing the interviews.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. Have a great one.